Welcome to Making Waves, independent voices for peace and justice on WSCA LP FM, Portsmouth Community Radio. This is Steve Diamond, here to introduce our show to you today, May 21st, 2005. Here's what we have coming up. In recognition of May 21st as Armed Forces Day in the U.S. and May 26th as National Windmill Day in the Netherlands, Damon Thomas interviews Greg Field of Peace Action Maine. Peace Action Maine has been conducting an economic conversion campaign, pushing for military installations to be converted to sustainable energy manufacturing. With the announcement of the upcoming closure of the Portsmouth Naval Shipyard, this also is of particular importance to our community at this time. In our second hour, we'll have announcements, excerpts from the Portsmouth City Council's Clean Water hearing earlier in May, and an episode of Voices of the World, exploring the impact of the U.S. war on Iraq on U.S. troops and Iraqis. First, some news with Jeff White.
Good afternoon, and it is May 21st, and here is the news for Making Waves. This story from the Associated Press. Fidel Castro led a march of 1 million Cubans past the U.S. mission Tuesday to demand the United States arrest a Cuban exile sought in the bombing of an airliner, accusing Washington of hypocrisy in its war on terror. Hours later, U.S. officials confirmed the militant was in custody. The Department of Homeland Security said it detained Luis Posada Carriles on Tuesday after the longtime Castro opponent granted interviews to TV stations and the Miami Herald for the first time since surfacing in the U.S. 2 months ago. Posada, a former CIA operative and Venezuelan security official, is wanted in the 1976 bombing of the Cuban airliner that killed 73 people. Posada was trained by the CIA, served several years in the U.S. Army, and took part in countless anti-Castro demonstrations throughout Latin America in the 1960s, and rose to a high-ranking post in the Venezuelan Security Agency. He has been a suspect in several terrorist bombings, the most serious being the 1976 airliner attack. He was twice acquitted in Venezuela in the airline bombing. In 1985, still jailed while prosecutors appealed, he escaped a Venezuelan prison and began a two-decade odyssey through Central America. Cuba's parliament speaker welcomed the news of Posada's detention, but questioned why the U.S. government took so long. Now Mr. Bush has to prove he is sincere about terrorism. What the United States has to do now is clear. If there is a request for his extradition, it has to attend to it according to its own laws. Venezuelan Interior Minister Jesse Chacon also added some pressure. This person is a terrorist. There is no other name for him. The ball is in Mr. Bush's court. Posada is still wanted in Venezuela, where he would face a possible retrial for the Cuban airline bombing. This is not a march against the people of the United States, said the 78-year-old Castro, differentiating between Americans and their government. It is a march against terrorism in favor of life and of peace. Our country has been the object of the most ferocious war in history, Castro added in brief comments to the crowd, referring to U.S. economic sanctions against the island and early U.S. government plots to kill him. Coinciding with the huge march in Havana, the Tuesday publication of the interview was certain to enrage Castro, who accuses the Bush administration of hypocrisy for taking no action against Posada while waging a global war against terrorism following the September 11th attacks. Castro also resents Cuba's inclusion on the State Department list of state sponsors of terrorism. This is the empire's answer, money to foment destabilization, he said, adding money for terrorist acts, money for subversion. According to the Washington Post, the arrest creates a dilemma for the Bush administration, which has taken a strong stand against terrorism in all forms, but has also been reluctant to cross the politically potent Cuban exile community in South Florida, many of whom support Posada. Most news organizations covering Posada's arrest led by pointing out the dilemma it poses for the Bush administration. The Australian Sydney Morning Herald piece on the story begins this way. Like many former Latin American allies of the U.S., Posada has become an international embarrassment. This story from antiwar.com. Five civil rights, animal rights, and environmental groups are joining together to sue the FBI to release records about monitoring of anti-war and other political activities by federal agents assigned to counter-terrorism duties. The American Civil Liberties Union said the decision to file a lawsuit Wednesday in the U.S. District Court in Washington came after the FBI ignored Freedom of Information Act requests for the documents. The other organizations involved are the Arab American Anti-Discrimination Committee, Greenpeace, People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, and United for Peace and Justice. The groups say they have been subjected to scrutiny by a task force set up to combat terrorism. We think that if they have some reason to hide from the public, the files they have on political and religious groups. We want to know right now what it is, said Ann Beeson, the ACLU's associate legal director. The FBI has denied singling out individuals or groups for surveillance or investigation based solely on activities protected by the Constitution's guarantees of free speech. The ACLU has been seeking FBI files on a broad range of individuals and groups that have been interviewed, investigated, or subjected to searches by the task forces. The requests also sought information on how the task forces are funded to determine if they are rewarded with government money for labeling high numbers of cases as related to terrorism. The ACLU provided a list of examples, including the Quaker-affiliated American Friends Service Committee that had been monitored by Denver police and was listed as an active case by a local terrorism task force. The FBI did release some records sought by the ACLU. They concerned two political activists in Colorado, one of them a 21-year-old intern for the Friends group. Sarah Bardwell has no criminal record, according to a partially censored report from the FBI Joint Terrorism Task Force in Denver. The report said her Denver residence was, quote, found to be associated with two groups that were of interest to the FBI. Bardwell said one of the groups, Food Not Bombs, distributes vegetarian food to the hungry. They are stretching as far as they can to insinuate that these organizations are doing something wrong, she said. The other person whose FBI file was released is Scott Silbert, 29-year-old former labor organizer for the Service Employees International Union. The FBI was engaging in a campaign to intimidate people who were working on progressive causes, he said. In this story from the New York Post, originally titled Brit Fries, Senators in Oil. British politician George Galloway went eyeball to eyeball with Senate investigators yesterday, calling allegations he took oil bribes from Saddam Hussein a pack of lies, and labeling the UN Oil for Food scandal probe the mother of all smokescreens. In an appearance before the Senate Permanent Subcommittee on Investigations that was stunning in its audacity, the anti-war member of Parliament launched a furious counterassault on President Bush and Republican probers. Galloway claimed the Oil for Food scandal was cooked up to slander anti-war critics. You have nothing on me, Senator, except my name on list, many of which have been drawn up after the installation of your puppet government in Baghdad, Galloway said to the panel's chairman, Senator Norm Coleman, Republican of Minnesota. I am not now, nor have I ever been an oil trader, and neither has anyone on my behalf. I know your standards have slipped over the past few years in Washington, but for a lawyer, you are remarkably cavalier with any idea of justice. Coleman and the other senators were caught flat-footed by the ferocity of Galloway's counteroffensive. They cut short the questioning of him and abruptly stopped the hearing. Galloway demanded to appear before the Coleman Committee after it released a report last week detailing evidence it obtained from Iraqi government documents in interviews with Saddam's top aides, including former Iraqi Vice President Taha Yassin Ramadan, now in U.S. custody. The committee said the new evidence indicates that Galloway received allocations for 20 million barrels of discount Iraqi oil. But Galloway counterpunched, calling facts in the report schoolboy hollers and challenging the evidence and the credibility of former regime witnesses, especially Ramadan. I know he is your prisoner. I believe he is in Abu Ghraib prison. I believe he is facing war crimes charges punishable by death, Galloway said. In these circumstances, knowing what the world knows about how you treat prisoners in Abu Ghraib prison, in Bagram Air Base in Guantanamo Bay, I'm not sure how much credibility anyone would put on anything you managed to get from a prisoner in those circumstances, Galloway added. Galloway, who was elected to a heavily Muslim district earlier this month despite being kicked out of the Labour Party, also denied he was a Saddam apologist and said he only met the butcher of Baghdad twice. As a matter of fact, I met Saddam Hussein exactly the same number of times as Donald Rumsfeld met with him, Galloway said, referring to meetings the defense secretary had during the Reagan administration. And this story is from the Associated Press. Some of the nation's top environmental groups said Tuesday that they will join the efforts of at least 13 states, including New Hampshire, hoping to force industry to install mercury pollution controls tougher than those imposed this spring by the Environmental Protection Agency. The EPA in March issued new regulations that said it would cut mercury pollution from power plants in half by 2020, from 48 tons a year now to 24.3 tons. The new rules rely on the markets to reduce pollution, with companies buying and selling allotted pollution limits. Opponents of the new rules contend the agency should have required each plant to install the most effective technology to capture mercury emissions. The Sierra Club, National Wildlife Federation, and the Environmental Defense Fund said they will file a separate legal challenge on Wednesday. This collective effort demonstrates widespread consensus that EPA's approach to regulating mercury and other air toxins from coal-fired power plants leaves public health at risk and violates the law, said Felice Stadler of the National Wildlife Federation. In this story from USA Today, the generation that came of age after September 11th fears college debt and joblessness more than another terrorist attack. That's according to a new survey of college seniors and graduates of the class of 2005, most of whom were just weeks into their college careers that fateful Tuesday. They still fear terrorism, and most believe that Americans will experience another attack, but when asked, "What are you most fearful at this time?" only 13.4 said a terrorist attack, 32.4 answered going deeply into debt, and 31.2 said being unemployed. The survey, released today by the Bipartisan Partnership for Public Service, finds that 45% say they will expect to graduate with $10,000 or more in college loans, and 21% saying they will have more than $20,000 to pay off. It's the central challenge that they face, says William Strauss, co-author of Millennials Rising and other books about Americans born since 1982. By 2001, Strauss said, these kids already had their sense of security altered by the Columbine High School shootings in 1999 and similar tragedies which prompted schools to reconsider safety years before the rest of the country. The adjustments that society made post 9/11 seemed less startling, and they were more willing to accept it, Strauss says. This is a larger issue than most people realize, he says. It's altering life directions. Rather than pursuing academic paths, they feel much more obliged to pursue the highest-paying corporate path. That is a significant change from 30 to 40 years ago. Samantha Yarborough, a senior at Oberlin College in Ohio, says debt burdens didn't change her career plans, but she adds that many friends opted not to travel for the year because they knew that their payments would start in October. Yarborough, 23 years old, of Flagstaff, Arizona, plans to attend law school eventually and run for elected office. She says September 11th wasn't really her generation's wake-up call. The Iraq war may have a more long-term impact, she says, but that the terrorist attacks were a shock that made them more aware of the United States' place in the world. And now for my favorite story of the week from the Associated Press. Without Michael Moore and Fahrenheit 9/11 at the Cannes Film Festival this time, it was left to George Lucas and Star Wars to pique European ire over the state of world relations and the United States' role in it. Lucas's theme of democracy on the skids and a rule of preaching war to preserve the peace predates Star Wars Episode III, Revenge of the Sith, by almost 30 years. Yet viewers Sunday and Lucas himself noted similarities between the final chapter of his sci-fi saga and our own troubled times. Cannes' audience made blunt comparisons with Revenge of the Sith, the story of Anakin Skywalker's fall to the dark side and the rise of an emperor through warmongering, to President Bush's war on terrorism and the invasion of Iraq. Two lines from the movie especially resonated. Quote, "This is how liberty dies, with thunder applause," bemoans Padme Amidala as the Galactic Senate cheers dictator-in-waiting Palpatine while he announces a crusade against the Jedi. Quote, "If you're not with me, then you're my enemy," Hayden Christensen's Anakin, soon-to-become villain Darth Vader tells former mentor Obi-Wan Kenobi. The line echoes Bush's international ultimatum after the September 11th attacks, quote, "Either you are with us or you're with a terrorist." That quote is almost a perfect citation of Bush, said Liam Engel, a 23-year-old French-American aspiring filmmaker. Plus, you've got a politician trying to increase his power to wage a phony war. Though the plot was written years ago, the anti-Bush diatribe is clearly there, Engel said. The film opened Wednesday in Europe and Thursday in the United States and many other countries. Lucas said he patented his story after historical transformations from freedom to fascism, never figuring when he started his prequel trilogy in the late 1990s that current events might parallel his space fantasy. "As you go through history, I didn't think it was going to get quite this close, so it's just one of those reoccurring things," Lucas said at the Cannes news conference. "I hope this doesn't come true in our country. Maybe the film will awaken some people to the situation." That comment echoes Moore's rhetoric at Cannes last year when his anti-Bush documentary Fahrenheit 9/11 won the festival's top honor. Unlike Moore, whose Cannes visit came off like an anybody-but-Bush campaign stop, Lucas never mentioned the president by name, but was eager to speak his mind on U.S. policy in Iraq, careful again to note that he created the story long before the Bush-led occupation there. When I wrote it, Iraq didn't exist, Lucas said, laughing. We were just funding Saddam Hussein and giving him weapons of mass destruction. We didn't think of him as an enemy at that time. We were going after Iraq and using him as a surrogate, just as we were doing in Vietnam. The parallels between what we did in Vietnam and what we're doing in Iraq now are unbelievable. The prequel trilogy is based on the backstory outline Lucas created in the mid-1970s for the original three Star Wars movies, so the themes percolated out of the Vietnam War and the Nixon-Watergate eras. Lucas began researching how democracies can turn into dictatorships with full consent of the electorate. In ancient Rome, why did the Senate, after killing Caesar, turn around and give the government to his nephew, Lucas said. Why did France, after they got rid of the king in that whole system, turn around and give it to Napoleon? It's the same thing with Germany and Hitler. You sort of see these recurring themes where a democracy turns itself into a dictatorship, and it always seems to happen kind of in the same way, with the same kinds of issues and threats from the outside needing more control. A democratic body, a Senate not being able to function properly because everybody's squabbling, there's corruption. And the band played on. And that's the news. Thank you very much, and have a great weekend.
Come, you masters of war. You that build the big guns. You that build the death planes. You that build all the bombs. You that hide behind walls. You that hide behind disks. I just don't want you to know I can see through your masks. You that never done nothing but build to destroy. You play with my world like it's your little toy. You put a gun in my hand and you hide from my eyes. And you turn and run farther when the fast bullets fly. Like Judas of old, you lie and deceive. A world war can be won. You want me to believe, but I see through your eyes. And I see through your brain, like I see through the water that runs down my drain. You fasten all the triggers for the others to fire. And then you sit back and watch when the death count gets higher. You hide in your mansion while the young people's blood flows out of their bodies and is buried in the mud. You've thrown the worst fear that can ever be hurled. Fear to bring children into the world. For threatening my baby, unborn and unnamed. You ain't worth the blood that runs in your veins. How much do I know? But to talk out of turn, you might say that I'm young. You might say I'm unlearned. But there's one thing I know. I'm younger than you. That even Jesus would never forgive what you do. Let me ask you one question. Is your money that good? or will it buy your forgiveness? Do you think that it could? I think you will find, when your death takes its toll, all the money you made will never buy back your soul. And I hope that you die, and your death will come soon. I follow your casket by the pale afternoon, and I watch while you're lowered down to your deathbed, and I stand over your grave till I'm sure that you're dead.
That was Masters of War by Bob Dylan. Next, we have an interview of Greg Field by Damon Thomas.
Good afternoon and welcome to another interview segment here on Making Waves. I'm Damon Thomas, and my guest for this portion of the show is Greg Field. Greg is Executive Director of Peace Action Maine in Portland, Maine, and we encourage you to stay tuned to what promises to be a very engaging and timely discussion on the topic of converting military installations and industry into environmentally sustainable non-military manufacturing, and the ramifications of what such a conversion might have upon job creation, meaningful work, knocking down the economic incentives for creating war and violence in the world, and the impacts, social, economic, environmental, that such installations have had on host communities. Residents of the greater Portsmouth-Kittery Seacoast area will find today's shows of particular relevance, given the recent Pentagon recommendation for closure of the Portsmouth Naval Shipyard. Greg, welcome to Making Waves, and thank you for taking the time to appear here today.
Thanks, Damon. I'm glad to be here.
As I understand it, Peace Action Maine is a nonprofit activist organization working to provide a voice of education and a center for all people committed to disarmament and creative responses to conflict. On April 1st of this year, they launched a two-year campaign to shift Maine's manufacturing base away from reliance on military industry. Greg, would you expand on the concept of economic conversion? What do we mean when we employ that term, and what would it entail?
Peace Action Maine has, in fact, committed itself to a multi-year program to try to work for conversion. And that question, you know, comes up all the time. What does that mean, economic conversion? And what it is the focus is on military contracting. Department of Defense contracting around the country has been embedded in almost every congressional district, every county, every region in this country, where economic development, jobs, decent jobs with benefits and protections for families, the kind of basic needs of our communities, have been tied to the boom and bust cycles of Pentagon contracting. And what we're trying to work for, when we have a vision of promoting peace, advocating, educating for these issues, is that we cannot ultimately get there without building a peace economy. In other words, when we base our economy, growth, jobs, the fundamentals of what we produce, on peacetime focus rather than things focused on war, weapons systems and things like that.
What is Peace Action's vision for economic conversion in Maine?
We've launched this project, and we are calling it the Sustainable Maine Economy, because we think that best reflects what our broad vision and then where we will go with the particulars of this program, how we will promote it, how we will try and make these things actually happen. And a sustainable Maine economy for us means that we've got a vibrant economic sector that's not dependent on the two sort of main growth sectors for jobs in Maine in recent years have been military contracting at both big places, BIW, which is owned by a large corporation, General Dynamics, and then smaller places throughout. And then the other sector has been call centers, which are very impermanent and generally poorer paying and jobs that don't have the kind of decent impact in the communities that we want. Our vision of a sustainable Maine economy would be one that envisions economic sectors such as manufacturing green energy products, renewable energy development here in this state, and promoting the increased use of products such as windmills, other renewable energy products, getting public investment in that. Already our country pours billions each year into weapons manufacturing. What if our country turned its creative energies and public investment to, for instance, renewable energy? What would that make our countryside and our nation look like? Our vision is that would mean economic growth, because renewable energy is there's a clear need and a growth sector there. It would mean decent manufacturing jobs. The decline of manufacturing in the Northeast, and in particular in Maine in recent years, we've been hit really hard. Textile mills closing. Shoe manufacturing has almost completely disappeared. And the metal trades have been hit very hard as well. So things like producing windmills, when we're going to be engaging in more and more increasing portion of our energy sector is going to be coming from things like windmills. Why not do some of the research and development and the manufacturing here rather than buying these windmills elsewhere?
I suppose the added argument, too, in this time of declining oil production and with America's dependency on foreign sources of oil, and of course talk of turning to other sources of energy such as nuclear power, which has huge environmental ramifications, if for no other reason than just for the solid waste disposal issue. It seems to me that the issue of renewable energy, insofar as it's concerned with economic conversion, is a very desirable goal.
It's not simply the case that we want to try and turn away from Pentagon contracting and building, you know, large weapons systems to go to anything else. It's sort of the old saying, be careful what you wish for because you might just get it. The best slash worst example of conversion in the 1990s is the Hummer. Most people are probably familiar with that. It was initially a completely military vehicle. And in the 90s, before there's been a big ramp in military production for the Iraq War, but in the 90s, there was a decline in military demand for Hummers, and they converted that factory to civilian use. So we have these huge, ugly status symbols that are sucking oil out there. So our vision is, what do we want? We want conversion, but we want it in areas that will promote, for instance, energy independence. If we're not dependent on fossil fuels, on oil, we remove the need for oil wars. We can turn our foreign policy in a much more progressive direction. And that's where I think peace activists, thinking about conversion, thinking about removing the need for oil wars, can link up with environmentalists who are talking about the need for green energy and solving climate change problems, and work with organized labor, because organized labor, what are people worried about? They're worried about losing decent jobs, and that's where I think these things can come together.
What is labor's response to your proposals for economic conversion? Are you in working in concert with other labor groups? Is a discussion on the table with respect to the issues? Because certainly job creation and loss of jobs and meaningful work for people is certainly something that I would think that you would have the support of labor on.
The conversations are just underway. And I think that, as one would expect, the range of reaction ranges from rejections that are based out of fear, I think. You know, that seems impossible to get to, and we have these jobs at, say, BIW or at the shipyard or things like that that are under threat. All of our focus has to be on protecting those jobs. So people are sort of holding on by their fingernails. It ranges from that up to, we've had some very fruitful discussions with people from the Central Labor Council in Southern Maine about this issue. The response is, this sounds like a great set of ideas. How do we put this into policy? So I think that's part of the discussion, is how we then build the coalitions, bring member groups from the different peace and justice groups, environmentalists, labor, together to start promoting policy, public investment. What would the tax incentive packages look like? The public investment in some startup companies to help get this kick-started, this, you know, green manufacturing sector going here in Maine and elsewhere across the country.
It brings to mind some observations made by the late Professor Seymour Melman of Columbia University, who was probably arguably the leading proponent over the last three decades of conversion of the economy from widespread dependency on military spending to non-military applications. One of his central points, and it's one that's been shared by renowned economists, was that as many studies have shown, because military production is so capital intensive, military spending creates relatively few jobs for every $1 billion invested. And in fact, military industries are one of the least efficient means of creating jobs. Your thoughts on this and on how economic conversion could favorably impact job creation?
Seymour Melman, who passed away just a few months ago, was definitely the sort of, from the 1970s onward, the leading spokesman for this, because what he was looking at is the way that this country's industrial base has been geared towards producing products that are really not useful in the economy. If you build large ships or missiles and the technology that goes into that, it is extremely capital intensive. And in fact, it does clearly produce fewer jobs for the investment than the civilian sector does. The other issue is it's also making things that then don't contribute to the economy. If you build a warship as opposed to light rail vehicles, if the rail vehicles you build and you put them to work in society, they're actually engaged in then creating more wealth. So it's a question of what helps the economy. And Melman was clearly the voice for that. So I think that's one of the important things to remember. One of the other issues around this that I try and bring up is that it's pretty clear that even in the best of times with the military contracts here in Maine, the big example here in Maine is Bath Iron Works, but there are many smaller firms dependent on military contracting throughout the state. In the best of times, when the contracts were running in the late 90s and into the early 2000s here at a fairly high level, and there were ships on a regular basis being built there, there was a constant stream of layoffs. Every year, that plant, BIW, has gone from a high of about 9,000 employees 10, 15 years ago to just a little over 6,000. They're losing 1-3% of their workforce every year. That's being laid off by General Dynamics, and so it is not something that is producing jobs. Jobs are being cut even while those contracts are going through.
President Dwight Eisenhower, when he left office around 1960, parting remarks warned the nation of the growing emergence of the military-industrial complex, and I don't have the quote in front of me, but I've seen it enough to know that I can paraphrase it to some extent. And what he said, among other things, was that every missile launched, every bullet manufactured, every battleship, in effect, constitutes a theft from needy people of the world, constitutes a theft from the children of the future, and it compromises the future of the well-being of humanity, because you're taking away resources that could have been allocated for peaceful means and instead directing them towards really destructive ends. It gives you pause to wonder how different the society could be if resources instead were allocated towards building the new schools or rebuilding the libraries, repairing the infrastructure, environmental cleanup, creating viable mass transportation, directing the resources to any number of areas that are so sorely needed, areas where the resources have been directed towards really military applications. And I'm wondering if you have any thoughts or comments on that.
I think you're right. That's what this country would look like if resources were devoted to these areas is just, I think it would point to that fundamental shift. And again, it ranges from the mega issues, the big issues like, again, reducing our dependence on fossil fuels and what that would mean for our foreign policy when we're not engaged in putting bases and thousands, hundreds of thousands of troops into places like Iraq around the oil resources there. But it's a question, what would our communities look like? And year after year, we find ourselves in these issues of, well, we can't afford something for our schools, or the cost of, for instance, medical care. I know that New Hampshire, in its current state budget rounds, was cutting the children of the working poor who were just above the poverty line off of the qualification list for medical insurance and medical care, and were, in fact, talking about instituting fees for even those who were eligible who fell under the poverty line because of things like the budget gaps were $10 to $12 million in one of the state Medicaid funding groups in New Hampshire. I try and put that in perspective. For instance, the cost of the war in Iraq, it's running at about $1.5 billion a week. The costs of the new jet fighter programs are multi-billion dollar enterprises. So people have to think about that framework every time we say we can't afford health insurance. Those are policy choices. They're political choices that we make as a country. every month, every year. And we can afford all those things if we turn away from this dependence on these hugely expensive and unproductive military enterprises.
Surely the point has been raised, engage in an ongoing conflict across the globe. And as the argument goes, America has a responsibility, a duty to its citizens and to the world to maintain safety and security. As America wages this so-called war on terrorism, to the extent that the global situation has changed since the 90s, in part because of the hysteria over terrorist incidents and America's place in the world with respect to how these incidents impact America, how does the argument that we need to maintain our vigilance in this time of war on terrorism, how does that impact upon your economic conversion campaign, and how do you address that issue when it does come up?
They're fair questions, because people can point, for instance, to what happened on September 11th, 2001, and say, you know, there are threats that face this country, and how do we deal with those? And you've got to respond to people's fear around some of those things. And I think the first thing to say is, what will make us more secure? And, for example, the Homeland Security funding for the state of Maine under President Bush's current budget proposal is cut by about 76%. That's money that would have gone to first responders, emergency rooms, public health communities, even to things like port security and things like that. But the first responders, the firefighters, these are the things that ultimately are identified through the Homeland Security program as things that would continue to make us more secure on an international basis, but also here at home, and they have a real impact in our communities. And that budget was literally 76% cut from last year to this year in Bush's current budget because of their spending, again, on large weapon systems, fighter planes, the, you know, the boondoggles. They're trying to promote a development of new nuclear weapons. These things, new nuclear weapons, first off, even if there is a threat from Al-Qaeda to the U.S. mainland, new nuclear weapons or large fighter planes are not going to make us more secure from that. I think the other thing to do, once you engage people in that discussion around how emergency rooms and public health officials and firefighters help make our communities more secure and how they need funding, the other thing to ask is also, why are United States interests engaged around the world in the way they are? Why do we have, for instance, a Navy that's designed to plunk itself down off the shores of these countries around the globe and project our power and interest overseas in the way it does? And I think that gets back to that question of resources and oil and things like that. And if we're not engaged in that kind of grab for an access to cheap oil and other resources, including cheap labor in sweatshops in Southeast Asia and Central America, then we can get at the real issues about what makes us and the world a better place.
Your comments brought to mind some remarks that Howard Zinn had made at a Forum for the Veterans for Peace in Boston this past summer, simultaneous with the Democratic National Convention. And he remarked that America makes itself a target. We have established bases throughout the world. We've established a presence that is despised by nations and peoples across the world. And a lot of it is based on our pursuit of foreign oil. And in doing so, we make ourselves a target that other nations are not. There are plenty of countries in this world, such as Canada comes to mind, that promote themselves as democracies and all. And they're not engaged in the same sort of activity in terms of what some would call an empire building or seeking these resources, that makes us such a solitary target to create opportunities where, in fact, we might be targets for terrorism or otherwise, as the case may be. So to that extent, I think your remarks are germane to this discussion, because what we do as a nation may very well create the conditions that give rise to the supposed need to keep the keep the cycle of violence and warfare going.
I think that's right. To my sense, the United States projects and has embedded within our sensibility, again, here at home, of who we are as a nation and how we project an image overseas. It's kind of, I guess I'm pop psychologizing here, it's sort of a split personality. On the one hand, we have this the so-called ugly American image, where it's an arrogance of power. It's a drive for empire, whether formal empire in the traditional sense or informal empire, and using our economic power to control other people's and other countries' destinies. And yet there's also this, again, this impulse, both here at home and abroad, towards justice, democracy, equality, a vision that people across the globe and here still hold dear, that we can still make that the predominant vision of what America wants to be. We have here in Portland, our office, Peace Action Maine's office is here in Portland, and here in the Portland area, we have the largest population of refugees from the Darfur region of Western Sudan that exists in any city in North America. And it's very interesting talking to them, because what they look for when we're doing some work with them, education, presentations around the state about the situation in Darfur, what needs to be done there, what they are appealing to when the members of this FUR cultural organization speak to people here in Maine, they appeal to that vision of the United States as a promoter of democracy, as a refuge. Again, you go back to the poem on the Statue of Liberty, the huddled masses yearning to be free, coming to this country. That's what they're hoping that America can be for them, and protect the people of the FUR region in Western Sudan. And so I think that's what we can talk about when we're trying to promote a new and sustainable economy. We can build an economy built on the visions of social and economic justice.
Why economic conversion right now? Why is now the time to launch this campaign?
I think the first answer to that is it's long overdue. The sort of old saying, if not now, when? If not me or us, who? Really, in the last 50 to 60 years, since the end of the Second World War, with the establishment of a large standing army during peacetime for the first time in the U.S. history, we never had a large standing army before the late 1940s, the growth of this military-industrial complex you were talking about, and the spread of military contracting across the country, it's really been long overdue to engage in this. So we're bringing it back because we're looking for a way to address building a more peaceful and just society. And again, it's that we can't do it without addressing the economic base. So what are the opportunities now? Well, the opportunities are that, again, I think progressive organizations sort of across a range of interests, environmental, labor, peace and justice, are all under assault. The right wing has built an incredibly powerful strategy and message. They are well funded, they are tightly knit in their organization, and they are moving an agenda forward. And we have to think about ways to build alliances across all our interests so that we are not just fighting our own little struggles in our own little spheres, and the environmentalists are dealing with, say, Bush's Clear Skies, quote-unquote Clear Skies Initiative, and his, I would say, pollution mandates. So we're not just dealing with the development of new nuclear weapons. So labor's not dealing with Bush's anti-union drive. I think we've got to pull these groups together and articulate a common message and common agenda.
Widespread militarization of the society has various environmental impacts, certainly on some of the host communities that host military installations or bases, but also otherwise. And I'm wondering if you could address some of these environmental concerns and how the economic conversion campaign would address them.
There's a kind of ironic set of opportunities around things. You mentioned the base closures, and one of the real questions at almost every base that is up for closing is what is the lay of the land there? Are there toxic wastes? When we talk about these bases and what's going to happen to them, that's a question that keeps coming up. So on environmental issues, one of the first things is, ironically, in the closing down, for example, of a nuclear weapons site in Ohio, one of the big opportunities for job growth, and it's a sort of unfortunate, again, ironic opportunity, is in the cleanup and the remediation and working through some of the problems. Most of these Department of Defense sites, both production facilities, private production facilities, and the bases themselves, have big problems with potential waste in brownfield, so-called brownfield sites. And there's a lot of work that needs to be done to clean these things up. So that's one issue that, again, I want to offer as a possibility for, it's an ironic possibility, but for hope for the future. You know, whether it's Portsmouth and whether Portsmouth ends up on the initial list and whether it ends up being, in fact, put on the final list and closed. And a lot of people are going to be worried about their jobs and the impact in the region. And we have to start thinking about what are the things that will need to be done to reuse those lands and put them to work for society at large.
There is great anxiety in the greater Portsmouth Kittery Seacoast area regarding the fate of the Portsmouth Naval Shipyard, and you've hinted at some of the struggles around the Bath Iron Works. Highlighting those two locations for a moment, if you could talk about some of your work centering around those two particular institutions, and if you could address the concerns that people have in each of those areas with regard to the environmental or economic or social impact that these facilities have had upon them or will have upon them, whether they remain open or closed.
A couple things. First, I think that it's pretty clear that the BRAC, the base closure, the base realignment and closure process, and the potential that Bath Iron Works may face significant downsizing because the Navy is talking about going to a quote-unquote one shipyard formula. That's where the Ingalls Shipyard in Mississippi would become the only shipyard producing the destroyers that BIW also now produces. So in many ways, the same cloud that hangs over Portsmouth and over Brunswick Naval Air Station hangs over BIW in Bath right now. And in all these cases, both the one shipyard formula and the BRAC, my first response is that, and some people have said to me, well, isn't this a good opportunity for Peace Action Maine because these things are closing down? My first response is, it's never good when people are losing jobs, economic livelihood, when, you know, local economies are getting hit this way. And I'm also trying to point people to sort of following the money. And in fact, both the BRAC and the one shipyard policies are not, they're talking about them as cost savings, but what they're doing is really cost realignment and cost shifting. And the shift is geographic, so that the squadrons of airplanes going from Brunswick Naval Air Station are going to Florida. Texas, if you look at the gains in jobs in placement from the BRAC system down in places like Texas in Florida. So throughout the South, and it is no surprise politically, again, I get back to the point that all of these choices about where we invest our money, whether it's in military or civilian sectors or regions, Northeast or Southeast, there are political choices here, and it is no coincidence that Virginia and Florida and Texas are the states that are benefiting from the BRAC closures, potentially benefiting from the one shipyard formula. So we are not benefiting as a region, and we are not benefiting as a nation from this current realignment process, because they're not altering the fundamental fabric of where our money, our tax money, is going. We want it to go into economic development, in green energy manufacturing, and other sectors that will produce more jobs and solve some of our pressing energy needs. And we don't want it just shifted to the Southeast.
Does the political will exist to effectuate, to bring about the changes that you've discussed?
Right now, no. I think, I'm always optimistic, but I am never naive. Or at least I like to think I'm not naive. And so it's pretty clear that right now, if you open up the mainstream media sources, the papers, what's the focus on? The focus is sort of around the BRAC or the one shipyard. It's using the limited political resources and pull of our representatives and senators in Washington to hang on to what we have, rather than to, and I hate using this, but I'll go ahead and do it, to think outside the box, right? To sort of step out of that sandbox. We don't want to play in that sandbox anymore, of clinging to some of that stuff, because if we don't lose it this time, we'll probably face, you know, further down the road efforts to close these things. So let's start thinking about ways that can promote these new developments, new sectors for the economy, and to ask for our policymakers to take the lead in pushing for this new investment, to invest in a future that would mean cleaner air, good jobs, no oil wars. Right now, do we have those political coalitions in place? No, we don't. I think look around, and what we've got is we're clinging to the crumbs, you know, holding on to a shrinking pie. It's pretty clear that the right wing has control of the political agenda, and that's why we're working on this long term. I don't think it's going to change in 6 months, a year, 18 months. What I hope we do out of this, my most fundamental hope beyond the issue of conversion, is that we've created conversations and dialogue among peace and justice activists, environmental groups, labor, that leads to a more enduring political coalition.
What would you encourage people to do who support your goals behind economic conversion?
There are practical things. In terms of the program we're doing, we are engaged in presenting some of these ideas and some initial policy initiatives in communities across the state. So if they've got a local business group, Rotaries, think again about, as well as peace and justice groups. We're happy to come and talk to local peace and justice groups, and we've been doing that, to make presentations on this and to begin to talk about what the first steps are. Anytime they have an opportunity, if there's a town meeting being held by an elected representative, bring these issues up, even in just a general way. Talk about public investment. What are they doing to promote public investment in clean energy? Just ask them that point blank. What are you doing to promote public investment in clean energy sectors? What are you doing to protect us so that we're not, you know, talking about more resource and oil wars down the road? The other thing to do is anytime these issues come up in terms of budget cuts at the local level, make that connection constantly. We are not more secure because of, you know, the Defense Department budgets. How does that impact your local school budget or the state budget or things like that? It connects all the time. If we spend $1.5 billion on an oil war in Iraq, $1.5 billion a week, what could that do here at home? So make those connections at public meetings, make them over the, you know, the water cooler conversations at your job, letters to the editor. But we're always available to come and we're happy to come and do some discussions, talk about what next steps are, talk about some initial policy measures.
Can you provide some contact information where people who are interested may be able to get in touch with you?
Yeah, Peace Action Maine's office is in Portland. We have a website, which is www.peaceactionme.org. That's all one word, peaceactionme.org. And we have some information on this work there, as well as calendars of upcoming events on other issues. We have an office in Portland where if nobody is in the office, it does have an answering machine. We always get back to people pretty promptly within a day or two. And the number there is area code 207-772-0680. So you're welcome to call and just leave a message you want to find out more about this. We also have a program committee. It's called our Action Committee, and that meets on the first Monday of every month at 6 o'clock here at the Peace and Justice Center of Southern Maine here in Portland. If you need directions, again, you're welcome to call, and we're happy to welcome new members or new people who come into that meeting every month. And if they've got interest in this program and becoming involved, helping us do presentations, working on brochures, PowerPoints, lobbying, that's always great. As well as if you've got ideas about other programs, that Action Committee is where our program works out of. So if you've got interests, we welcome you there.
Do you have any concluding thoughts or remarks that you would want our listeners to take note of?
I guess in conclusion, I would just, again, try and remind listeners what I try and remind myself every day, and that is to have hope for the future and to find it in the work around us, no matter how depressing the situation gets, how much our current administration and the powers that be promote fear, that our vision rests on hope for the future. And that we stick to that, and that we base our work on hope, not fear.
Greg, I want to thank you once again on behalf of Making Waves. You've been listening to Greg Field from the Peace Action Maine. I'm talking about economic conversion, and we trust that our listeners have had an opportunity to learn something today. Obviously, your remarks and comments are welcome, both WSCA here at 603-430-9722, or to address them directly to Peace Action Maine at the numbers and websites that Greg has indicated. Thanks once again for joining us for this segment. I'm Damon Thomas. I'll see you next week.
Seven seas, relative humanities. Everywhere I look, I see someone looking back at me. Nation states and borderlines, divided states of mind. Politics comes to blows, and everybody wants to know, whose world is this? Whose world is this? Whose world is this? First world riding high, second world standing by, third world under fire. Funny how we all conspire. We don't know, 'cause we can't see how such a way could come to be. Riding on a spinning wheel, soon enough will be revealed. Whose world is this? Whose world is this? Whose world is this? What kind of world would our children be seeing? After all is said and done, what kind of creed have we come to believe? That they may never receive one. Our children receive. After all is said and done, what kind of creed must we come to believe if they are ever to receive one? Seven seas, relative humanities. Everywhere I look, I see someone looking back at me.
That was Jim Page with Whose World Is It? To hear our previous shows, please visit our archive online at www.freewebs.com/sprav/audio.htm. You can also email us at nhmakingwaves@yahoo.com and let us know what you think about our show. And feel free to call the station in the next hour for more information, 430-9722.